for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Tiny Tim, Ebenezer Scrooge, and the Cratchit family are as much a part of Christmas today as Christmas trees and Santa Claus. A Christmas Carol changed how people celebrate the holiday and revived Dickens' career. Author Les Standiford tells the story of how Dickens came up with the classic tale, why it was self-published, and how it breathed new life into a holiday that had become just a minor celebration. His new book is titled The Man Who Invented Christmas, and Les Standiford joins me in the studio. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your comments about this book and about the Cratchit family in A Christmas Carol. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Les, it's good to see you.
What a pleasure it is to be here, Diane. I've listened to the show for so many years. Thank you.
Set the stage for us. What was Christmas like before A Christmas Carol was written?
Well, Christmas had been on the church calendar since the 4th century when Pope Julius came up with the idea to create it. But by Dickens' time, it was not much celebrated. In fact, it had become illegal to celebrate Christmas in England. The Puritan-dominated Parliament enacted in 1644 a law that literally could put you in prison, put you in the stocks if you were to celebrate the holiday, because it was considered pagan-influenced. And while that law was rescinded in the 1660s during the time of the Restoration, Christmas still suffered from perception that it was unseemly and licentious, in fact, that it was unchristian, if you will, to celebrate Christmas. Even in the U.S., it was illegal.
So that you had nothing of what one has today, and some people may say what you have today is an excess of celebration in the sense of having perhaps even lost the fundamentals of what Christmas is all
about.
Yeah,
certainly the commercialism. Dickens would be as appalled as anyone else would be with how that has become so much a part of Christmas. But at the time, Christmas was still known and celebrated in some rural enclaves by the so-called superstitious. Sir Walter Scott, Washington Irving had written in lamenting terms, oh, what a shame that Christmas isn't celebrated. But Dickens was far more proactive. He said, yes, it's true that we've lost Christmas, but let's do something about it, by George, and he did.
So he actually, according to your title, invented Christmas.
Well, I'd say it's something
of a stretch
to say that he invented it, but it wouldn't make much of a title to say the man who reinvented Christmas. And certainly there's no gainsaying the fact that he did bring Christmas back to popularity, and that there was a confluence of factors. Queen Victoria just married Prince Albert, who was from Bavaria, where, in fact, Christmas was very much a celebrated holiday, and he was all for this. But most commentators agree, and the British press at the time of Dickens' death talked about his passing, and the sobriquet they gave him was the man who had invented Christmas, and that's where the term comes from.
What was going on in Victorian England at the time he wrote A Christmas Carol?
Well, I think one of the reasons why the society was prime for this book and prime for a revival of Christmas, it was a time that was referred to in British history as the Hungry 40s. And it was a terrible, difficult time, hard times, much like on our horizon. And brought about really cyclical boom and bust cycles that the Industrial Revolution carries along with it. There are times when business is good, well, people go to work. When times are bad, the assembly lines are closed down and people are out of work. And this was one of those times.
So people were down in the dumps.
Very much so.
How did the story begin to come to him?
Dickens had an interesting thing. The popular notion is that once a fellow like Dickens got his foot in the door of publishing, the skids were always greased. But the fact is, while he had become the first literary superstar, the J.K. Rowling or the Stephen King of his era, you might say, with the Pickwick Papers and the Old Curiosity Shop, he was selling 100,000 copies of a book, reaching a quarter of the literate population of the country. Imagine what that would mean today, 60, 70 million copies of a book sold. And yet, because of some missteps, he wrote a book called American Notes about his travels in America, which disappointed him greatly. And then he began to serialize Martin Chuzzlewit, and it was seen as rather mean-spirited and negative in its tone. And all of a sudden, he found himself selling 20% or fewer of what he had been before. The critics had turned against him, and he was facing bankruptcy. He was dejected and ready to quit writing altogether, as he wrote to his agent and his friend, John Forster, and moved to the continent where he thought he might be a travel writer. And in time, people might begin to miss him, and then he might come back. And he traveled to Manchester. He had accepted a speaking engagement before a working man's organization called the Athenaeum at the behest of his sister who lived there. And he went up and he gave the speech. And the response was so enthusiastic that during the course of it, Dickens reminded himself of what had always moved him to want to be a writer in the first place. And he walked his social consciousness, chiefly, I'm talking about. And he walked the streets of Manchester that night wondering what had gone wrong, where he might have gone wrong. And by the next morning, he had come up with, he thought, the idea that would make his career right and change the world.
And he began to write this and completed it in how much time?
Well, this was early in October when he gave the speech, and he went back to London, and he went to his publishers, Chapman and Hall, and told them this wonderful idea he had. He knew what he'd been doing wrong, and this book was going to turn everything around. And Chapman and Hall said, "Dickens, lie down until that urge to write a ghost story of Christmas passes, because people don't even celebrate Christmas in these parts." And furthermore, here it is mid-October, and you're talking about, and you've got a great idea, but you don't have a word down on paper. How on earth do you think we can publish a book in time for Christmas? Forget it. We'll do a quick paperback reissue of some of the stuff of yours that people used to like. Well, Dickens walked out of that meeting crestfallen, of course, and angry, and then he told Forster, "I'll do it myself. If they won't publish it, I'm sure this is right."
And that's what he did.
He spent the last little bit of cash he had. He got a loan from Forster, spent what it took, and wrote that book, designed it, hired an illustrator, a man named John Leach from Punch, noted illustrator of his time, and had the book printed and bound and delivered to bookshops by December 19th.
Wow. How many copies did he sell initially?
6,000 copies. Beautiful book, and designed to sell at about less than a quarter of the normal price for a book at its time, because he wanted everybody to have access to this. So all 6,000 copies snapped up, gone before Christmas. An instant bestseller, and the number of copies since, of course, really beyond counting.
And then an American publisher got involved.
Oh, and they did. Not in the way Dickens would have hoped for.
Exactly.
As one commentator said, the pirates must have been waiting at the docks the day they arrived in New York. 3 days later, there was a pirated edition on sale for pennies by Harper and Brothers. And Dickens never saw a cent of that, because at the time, there was no such thing as copyright law.
Was his name even on the book?
On that book, yes. But there were also renditions produced, even in England, purported to be homages, you might say, to the original, but essentially a reprinting of the story with someone else's name on it.
And he got not a dime
Not out of that. And finally, Dickens got so upset, he did sue those people. And he won. It was a summary. The judgment was delivered in a trice, and those pirated editions were taken off the shelves. But in the U.S., there wasn't anything he could do. It was 1860. Now, Christmas Carol published in 1843. It was 1860 before Dickens ever signed a contract that gave him money for a publication of his work in the United States, even though every book had been reprinted there.
How many copies of A Christmas Carol have been sold throughout the world? Do you know?
It's in the millions. No one knows, because for the very reason that so many editions in the public domain now had translated into most languages known to man, literally beyond counting.
How extraordinarily frustrating that must have been for him.
Well, actually, he was heartened. It did have the effect that he intended. People loved the book. The critics loved the book. William Thackeray, one of the most brutal critics who's ever lived, said of it, and who'd scolded Dickens on more than one occasion, read this book and said, who can listen to objections to such a work as this? It seems to me a national favor to every man, woman, and child.
And then he began public readings of the book.
That's, you know, he had, when he read the bottom line from the publisher after the initial editions were sold in middle of 1844, he was surprised to find out that he hadn't made any money because he had spent so much in the production values of the book and took in so little that he determined never to make that mistake again, even though he published more Christmas books.
Les Standiford. He's the author of The Man Who Invented Christmas. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm talking with Les Standiford about his book, How Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol, Rescued His Career and Revived Our Holiday Spirits. The book is titled The Man Who Invented Christmas. And I must say, the book looks like Christmas, Les. It's just grand. But he did do so many public readings, he managed to make money that way, did he not?
Yes, I started to say he spent so much money on the production of the original edition that he didn't make much profit on it, even though it was wildly popular and it did restore him in the eyes of the public. Where he really earned anything off this book was in giving public readings of it. Many of them in the 1850s and 60s, right up to the time of his death, he loved to do it. He was a big ham. He wrote plays. He loved to act. And he loved to give these readings. And he would read the entirety of A Christmas Carol, 3 hours and a half. And what's more, audiences would sit entranced to listen to it.
We all have our favorite. Someone has written in that the 1980s version starring George C. Scott as Scrooge was the one he loved the most.
That's a very good version.
Mine is that with Lionel Barrymore going all the way back. But talk about Dickens' childhood, because so much of this sense of penury, of debt, of not having enough came out of his own childhood.
That's right. All his life, he considered, and in all his works, you could see that he considered the ignorance and want the bane of a civilized society, and attacked them every chance he was given. And I think, in large part, this derives from his experience at 12, when his father and his whole family, in fact, his sister and his mother, were put into debtor's prison. And only Charles himself stayed out of prison because he went to work trying to pay off this debt of 40 pounds to a baker for their bread, for heaven's sakes. He went to work in a boot polish manufacturing warehouse and tied off little pots of boot blacking day in and day out in a warehouse on the banks of the River Thames full of rats. And he wrote in an autobiographical sketch, never shown to his wife, anyone but John Forster during the time of his life, how deeply and profoundly these experiences moved him. And that's one reason, critics agree, why he was always a champion of the downtrodden, because he'd been there himself.
At the same time, even though his father and the rest of the family, excluding him, went to prison, his father was earning something like 300, 400 pounds a year.
Well, what Dickens, yes, it's true that he had a decent job. He was a naval pay clerk. It wasn't like he had been a homeless person or something. And Dickens, later on in life, discovered that his father had been one of those people who'd made 340 pounds a year and spent 350, and always lived just slightly beyond his means. And even after Dickens had begun to make considerable money as a writer, his father and his mother were sort of after him to help keep them and the rest of the family afloat. So Dickens, who'd gone to work selflessly on behalf of his family at age 12, by the time he was an adult, had begun to figure it out and realize that he came from a family of profligates.
And how long in their lives did he offer help?
Always. He didn't like it, and he began to complain about it. And, he would do things like move his mother and father from London out into the countryside, where he thought they couldn't spend money, but sure enough, they found a way.
Les Standiford, the book is titled The Man Who Invented Christmas. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. There was a relationship that you found between Washington Irving and Charles Dickens.
Well, Washington Irving was a great Anglophile himself, loved British culture, and while he was living in the United States, was a great fan of Dickens' work and urged Dickens to come over and visit. He was responsible for Dickens' tour. And Dickens, as a youth, had fantasized the grandeur of America, loved the democratic ideal and the promise of the frontier, and really, for a long, long time, had wanted to visit. And he finally talked his publisher into giving him an advance that would allow him a little break from writing. He'd been churning them out, mind you. And he said, look, I'll go over there. If you'll give me this money, consider it an advance on a book, my travel diary in America, the book that would become American Notes. And Chapman and Hall, well, they'd made a lot of money off of him, so they decided, okay, away you go, Dickens. And that's how he came to America, met the leading political lights, was received at the president's house, where he began to be disillusioned. He found lobbyists and others waiting to call on the president, spitting tobacco and sometimes not even bothering with the spittoons. And, there were other aspects of American manners he found rough. And then he was besieged and criticized by the press. They found his dress a little too foppish. They didn't think his wife was very attractive. They didn't think he spoke clearly enough, and on and on and on the complaints went. And until he finally said, I can't stand it. He and his wife fled, cut their trip short, and they fled to Canada, spent a few weeks, and then came back. And then he wrote all this up.
What was the press reception he had in his own home country. How did that compare with what was going on in the States?
Well, he was idolized in England. He was far and away the most popular writer who had ever lived. Just to give you an idea, he was selling 100,000 copies of installments of the old Curiosity Shop. Sir Walter Scott, who was the previous biggest literary star in history, in English history, would publish around 10, 12,000 copies of a book. When a little later on, when Dickens was publishing 100,000 copies of David Copperfield or Great Expectations, Thackeray, Vanity Fair, might sell 5,000 copies. So his star was firmly set in the firmament up until those bad books, until American Notes and Martin Chuzzlewit came out. And then the press turned on him.
Turned against.
Almost to say, well, yes, what have you done for us lately, Dickens? And it was a terrible disappointment to him, who felt, and his agent felt, that Martin Chuzzlewit was the best work that he'd ever done. But it hadn't struck a chord. In some ways, it is a very good book, but it wasn't a popular book. It was a little too mean-spirited, and people weren't buying it, that's for sure.
One question that numerous people have raised about A Christmas Carol is that there is not a single Christmas tree in the story.
Nor a gaily wrapped Christmas present. No, there is no gift in A Christmas Carol aside from the prize turkey that Scrooge has the street urchin, the one twice the size of Tiny Tim, taken over to the Cratchit house. It's odd to think of that, but it's true. Dickens knew of Christmas trees. Christmas trees were seen here and there in England, but the practice was not popularized until after the publication. It became one of the accoutrements of the Victorian Christmas, partly because Queen Victoria, had just married Prince Albert, who came from Bavaria, where they did celebrate Christmas and where Christmas trees were popular. And Queen Victoria loved this book, and as did most everyone else. And Albert said, and furthermore, when we celebrate Christmas, we'll have a tree. And it wasn't long before there was what you might call the national tree was being erected in the palace, and it would be whatever decorative nature it had this year would be featured on the front pages of all the newspapers and the magazines, and so that custom took off right at that time in the wake of the publication of The Man Who Invented or The Christmas Carol.
We have lots of callers. Let's open the phones now. 800-433-8850. First to Cleveland, Ohio. Good morning, Andrew. You're on the air.
Oh, good morning, Diane. It's such a pleasure to be on your show.
Thank you.
Thank you. I drive all day as a courier, so thank you for many, many mornings of great news and coverage. This story is so special to me. My family had a great blow right before Christmas when I was 9 years old. My father had a massive stroke. And I remember before that, my mother had taken me to see Christmas Carol at Dundas, a marionette show. And it blew my mind that there was this spooky but mystifying aspect to Christmas that I'd never thought of. And I connected with everybody in the book, trying to do everything they could to still have a Christmas and to still stay true to that spirit, even though throughout the years they would be reminded of their plight and their station. And of course, every year on December 13th, we all kind of got downhearted in my family because that was the anniversary of my dad's stroke.
Sure.
But I'm always kind of fell back to the story to kind of help me get through it. And I was an Alistair Sim man myself, Diane. You mentioned Mr. Barrymore, but I'm much more of the Alistair Sim mind, and I actually frustrated the heck out of an ex-girlfriend of mine, because when she dragged me to Vegas with some friends of hers, the thing that mystified me the most was seeing in an upscale gift shop in, I think, the Bellagio, a signed edition of Christmas Carol. I wouldn't shut up about it.
Wow.
I couldn't afford it to save my life.
Sure.
I was just like, oh, forget the guitar signed by Elvis. There's a signed copy of Christmas.
How many are there, do we know?
We're not sure how many exist of those 6,000, but it'll a copy of the first edition in fine condition would set you back about $40,000, as much as $40,000 these days.
Andrew, I understand that feeling of the anniversary of your father's death, and I empathize. My mother died on New Year's Day, so that's always a tough way to begin the year. Thanks for calling. Let's go to Rochester, New York. Good morning, Keith.
Yes, I'd like to know how any literary work is fleshed out so that it becomes a living creation in the collective public mind. I've read The Christmas Carol at least several times, and I just have to say I found the writing to be flat and even uninspiring. It starts off on the first page describing Scrooge, and I'm just wondering if I had read that for myself in 1843 and taking into the context of what you've been talking about, how Christmas was not being observed, I simply would have put the story down.
Oh, dear. We lost him, but we get his question. How did it become such a vibrant, living, breathing work?
Well, you know, the fact of the matter is that in the popular conception, it may seem that A Christmas Carol is a piece of melodrama, a piece of fluff, but when you read the book, it's actually pretty tough. And Andrew there a moment ago was saying he saw this spooky show, and he mentioned the Alastair Sim adaptation of 1951, which was panned by Variety in the United States when it was released because it is tough and it's dark. And I think that's one of the things that made people respond to, as they have and continue to respond to it, because it pulls no punches in its treatment.
At 26 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Here's an email from Ellen in Columbia, Missouri, who says, it seems so ironic that Dickens, who I believe identified himself as a Unitarian, brought us our modern Christmas celebration. I think he probably was most interested in the social justice opportunities that Christmas would provide. His ghosts are all giving us a message of caring for the less fortunate, and yet his message morphed into our excessive consumerist Christmas, now crumbling around us and leading to the kinds of economic and social inequalities and now distress that inspired him originally.
Well, that's true, and I think that's one reason why it might be good to go back and read A Christmas Carol and see how profoundly compassionate Dickens was for the downtrodden of this society. That fellow that you see outside a store this season beside an iron kettle and clanging a bell, that's really Charles Dickens reminding us of the right thing to do. And I believe if you take a look and read the whole of A Christmas Carol, most people are as captivated today as they were in 1843 when it
came out. You know, all the charities are suffering, and I'm sure the Salvation Army is probably among them. So I do think that for our own sort of emotional and mental health, it would be a good idea to reread A Christmas Carol in addition to your own book, Les, The Man Who Invented Christmas. Wayne in Cleveland, Ohio, you're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi, Wayne. Go ahead.
Well, this is a good follow-up from the last question because I this is very timely for me because I'm actually writing a sermon for Sunday that connects Dickens' life story with his writing of The Christmas Carol.
Good.
And I was interested in, since obviously some of my members are going to be listening to this. I want to make sure I get my facts right. My research turns up that he had a pretty strong relationship with a congregation and with his minister, Edward Taggart, in the Unitarian Church he was part of at the time he wrote the Christmas Carol. Do you know anything about that, sir?
Very, very little. I can tell you that Dickens himself was not a particularly doctrinaire person so far as religion went, and that may be one reason why he found the Unitarian Church attractive to him. You certainly don't get religiosity, overt religiosity, in the man who invented Christmas. I think, purposefully skirted that and went to the essence of the concept of charity and goodwill and strength in family. Wanted to do that on purpose.
Wayne, when you complete that sermon, love to see a copy of it.
I would, too.
Send it to drshow@wamu.org. Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, featuring the relaunch of its website, germany.info, with a new design and interactive features, online at germany.info. By WAMU's The Conversation, with listener-generated discussions and a monthly online chat with Diane Rehm. More information at conversation.wamu.org. And by the Gruber Family Foundation for support of NPR's international coverage. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After supporting roles in over 50 films and playing the deceased patriarch of the Fisher family in HBO's 6 Feet Under, whose ghostly presence hovered over the family, Richard Jenkins got his first leading man role in the recent film The Visitor, now out on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Richard Jenkins. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And here's an email, perhaps you already know about this, Les. It's from Rebecca in Stockton, New Jersey, who says, I believe the original handwritten copy of A Christmas Carol resides in the Morgan Library Museum in New York City. It's really something to see, written in the author's own hand.
Well, it is indeed, and I just saw it there. The Pierpont Morgan Library puts that on display every Christmas season, and while I was there, there were a steady stream of families coming in to look and parents holding their children up so they could gaze down at this manuscript, and they'd be telling them what it was. And you see in there the meticulous care with which Dickens went at this story. There isn't a line on a page that hasn't been crossed through and marked up.
I was about to ask, just how much marking up there was.
Morgan was a great collector, and Dickens, instead of giving his agent Forster a copy of the book in 1843 at publication time, gave him the original manuscript, which he kept until after Dickens' death. Passed from that collector to Morgan in the early 1890s, and then has resided first in Morgan's private library, and now along with the Gutenberg Bible and other things, in the library that's open to the public.
Just how precious it is. Here's an email from Marilyn, who says, in Sierra Leone, where I lived for 20 years, first as a Peace Corps volunteer, my students studied Great Expectations, and A Christmas Carol was a special treat. I think I own every dramatized version of this wonderful story. Don't forget the often overlooked Albert Finney musical version called Scrooge and the fabulous Muppet Christmas Carol starring Michael Caine and Kermit the Frog.
Oh, there have been so many wonderful.
How many?
Upwards of 250 at this point in time. Can you imagine any other novel that's had that kind of impact? And that's, to be truth be told, one of the reasons why the book has stayed a part of the public consciousness for so long, that it keeps getting told and retold. And there'll be another one out next Christmas starring Jim Carrey, playing seven major roles in the film.
Oh, my gosh. Here's an email from Paula in Flagstaff, Arizona, who says, lately I've been reading a Mickey Mouse version of A Christmas Carol to my three-year-old son. He loves this story, wants to hear it every night, although his imagination is especially captured by the ghosts. I'm sure the moral message is not lost on him.
I think that's one of the real triumphs. And I should say that all the great names have had their hand at adapting the story. Everyone from Lionel Barrymore to Beavis and Butthead have had their try at this. Yes, I think one of this is the great genius here of Dickens, who realized that if he clothed his moral ideas in characters and a story that captivated people, he would get them, so to speak, morally, before they know they were got. And that's what you have there with those ghosts and with the overall contour of this story. People are responding on a very human level, and then at the end of it, they begin to reflect on what it means and why they've been so taken in by this.
Let's go to Concord, North Carolina. Good morning, Carl.
Hi, this is Carl. I'm a former colleague of Les's back in the early to mid-90s at FIU. My question really dealt with the economic message, but I think that's been covered, so Les, can you tell us how you got interested in this topic and move on from those great murder mysteries that my wife and I have read every one of?
Oh, Carl, thanks for calling.
Well, I started off as a novelist, and some people have asked me, do I miss writing those thrilling stories? And I say, no, I still think I'm writing thrilling stories. It's just that these happen to be true. In this case, I was just finishing up work on a book about how Washington, D.C. came to be and worrying about what I was going to do next, because I always fear that if I finish one thing without knowing where I'm going, I'll never get started. And I got an email asking a series of questions about Charles Dickens. Did I realize this, that, and the other thing about it, that he was broke, that his critical reputation was in the dumper, and that he had to publish the book himself? And I said no. I'd studied Dickens in graduate school, but this sort of thing had never come up. And I went looking for the book that these facts had been pirated from and then distributed around the internet. And because I wanted to read that book. And what did I find out? But that book hadn't been written. And so then I knew what I was going to do next.
Good for all of us, I must say. Let's go to Jacksonville, Arkansas. Hi, Richard.
Hello.
Hi there. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is, it's been a controversial holiday, and he wrote it during those turbulent times. How did he get it to where he didn't have any opposition, or did he have opposition?
He only suffered economic opposition, because Chapman and Hall simply thought they couldn't make any money off of it, and they also wondered if, practically speaking, he could pull it off in time. And there was some opposition to it from from Churchman. I don't know if you've seen the, some of the trailers for the movie Doubt, where the nun says, well, we can't sing Frosty the Snowman at the school, at the church Christmas program, because Frosty the Snowman is symbolic of the pagan belief in the supernatural, and that would not be appropriate. That's the same kind of thing that Dickens got. He got a little of that, yeah.
This is the brand new movie with Meryl Streep you're yes. talking about. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
Me
Let's
too.
Go to Houston, Texas. Margaret, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to share, my family's favorite was the Mr. Magoo Christmas Carol.
Jim Backus, yeah.
We grew up in the era where all those specials only came on once a year, so we all gathered around waiting and waiting, and since that time, my brother and I have shared back and forth first the videotape and then the DVD. We kind of make a family ritual of mailing it from Texas to New York and sitting around our TVs one night of Christmas season to watch it.
Well, that's great.
We just love Mr. Magoo.
All right. Thanks for sharing. That's which is your favorite, or do you have one?
Well, it's hard. I think the Albert Finney musical is a very good adaptation. It wasn't given very much credit in its time, but I think it holds up well. The score holds up well. The George C. Scott version has been mentioned. The Bill Murray Scrooged adaptation is one of the ones that goes a little bit afield and reinvents the story, I think, in an interesting way. But for my money, the most accomplished and in its way faithful to the original is the 1951 version that stars Alastair Sim, which wasn't very popular here in the States when it was first out, because there's some pretty grim and dark moments and very frightening for children. I remember seeing it when I was young, and it was very much a ghost story, but it's an excellent piece of work.
Someone has written, let's see, it's from Cindy. She says, I think the version with Patrick Stewart is one of the best. Could you ask if the adaptation was accurate to the times of the book?
Well, yes, I think it is. And I think other than works like Scrooged or Beavis and Butthead, where you obviously know the writer intends to go far afield, that most of the major film adaptations have done their very best to recreate, to be faithful to the story, but also recreate the world in which it was set, and certainly that's true of the Patrick Stewart. They all take, being dramas and being films, they all take necessary liberties with the original text, and that's why it's so important to go back and read A Christmas Carol, where you sometimes get language and description that simply cannot be transferred across to the screen. You don't really get what A Christmas Carol is without going back and reading it. And you'd be amazed, I think, at how modern it is, how some of the wonderful one-liners are the stuff of a mordant, witty comic of our day. Jonathan Winters reads this in a recorded version, and it's right up his alley. You can tell he relishes every zinger that Scrooge delivers.
Isn't that interesting? To Reston, Virginia. Good morning, Jim. Jim, are you there? Okay, to Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hi there, John.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Well, I was listening to your show, and strangely enough, to my family, which happened to be a long time ago, my parents did acquire a set of dishes that were made in England by Adams, and it says the Pickwick Papers, and illustration by the Pickwick Papers of Great Britain. The illustrations on the round plate, very beautifully decorated. It says the first appearance of Mr. Samuel Weller. The second one's Oliver Hemmings at the Dodgers made of getting to Worth when they were pickpocket kids. The next one was Mr. McCover deliver remarks at the office, and the other one said Mr. Pickwick addresses the club, and the last one that I have is the Old Curiosity Shop. And then I have also some square plates with Mr. Pickwick in front of his home, Oliver Twist heading to London, and where the market says 63 miles, and then sitting at his home with clothes, drying clothes in his home.
Are you aware of those sets of dishes?
Well, I haven't seen the dishes, of course, but take good care of those because they're certainly quite valuable. There was an entire cottage industry that sprang up. Pickwick was so popular that all sorts of products grew out of it. There were Pickwick cigars. There were ashtrays. There were articles of clothing. It's a testament to how deeply ingrained Dickens was in the culture of his time. Imagine, selling books to a quarter of the literate population. That's just a remarkable achievement. And then, in addition to those 100,000 people who were buying, we don't know how many people would gather in pubs to hear the latest installment of a work published, which I should mention, A Christmas Carol is the first book that Dickens wrote continuously from first to last, because, well, obviously he had to if he was going to get it done in time. All those other books were published in installments of 20 and then rebound later on as a whole.
Did he end up a wealthy man?
Extremely so. As I said before, I think A Christmas Carol was his ticket back to the big leagues. He sat down the next year and wrote excitedly to his agent, "I'm going to write a Christmas book that will knock A Christmas Carol out of the park, and I've already begun it, and it's called The Chimes." And of course, today, almost no one has ever heard of it. He went on to write 5 Christmas books in total, published them at Christmas time, although none of the others ever featured Christmas as a character. And none, of course, have had the staying power that this had.
At 7 minutes before the hour, you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. And to Rebecca in Charlotte, North Carolina. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Hi, know that The Christmas Carol has become ubiquitous, not just as a story that's read, but also on the stage. You see it in so many places. I remember acting in A Christmas Carol when I was in middle school, and I'm wondering if your guest knows when this book was first adapted to the stage, and if Dickens might have been around to see a performance of it.
Oh, he very much was around. It received numerous stage publications the following Christmas season, and very popular both on both sides of the Atlantic. Again, this was something that Dickens received no money for. There were no royalties. There was one authorized production in London that he saw a bit of remuneration for, but the others, it was considered quite all right to take a novelist's work and freely adapt it on the stage, as this was many, many times.
Where are you going to be for Christmas?
I'm going to London. We're going to do an event over there. There, a retrospective showing of the Alastair Sim version of the film, after which I'll get to talk and have copies of my book.
I'm sure that that's available now on video, and there are going to be tons of people who are going to want to see that. So I'm sure they'll enjoy it. Dominic in Kalamazoo, Michigan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, I just guess I wanted to comment on the, when I grew up, my mom and my father and my sister, we'd always watch the Disney adaptation of The Christmas Carol, where Scrooge Duck was obviously was Scrooge, and it felt like that was one of the great adaptations, and we always used to watch the cartoon version when I grew up, and I was wondering if your guest had any comments on that one.
Oh, I think Mickey's Christmas Carol, I think that's what you're referring to, is one of the great cartoon versions of it, along with the Muppet version, which I like, happen to like. And I might say Scrooge, which we see as a noun today, as was in Dickens' time a verb meaning to crush or to squeeze. And so that's where the name of the character came from. And I also might say that Dickens had a younger brother, sickly younger brother, named Fred, upon whom the character of Tiny Tim is based. And all I can say is thank heaven he had the good sense to make it Tiny Tim and not Tiny Fred.
Yeah.
Doesn't have the same ring.
Yeah, exactly. Did Tiny Fred actually go to prison with his mother and father?
No, he was born after them.
He was born after that. And the family ended up fairly comfortably.
Yes, they did, although there were bouts of bankruptcy that went on through Dickens' young adult life. And eventually Dickens became the breadwinner for everyone.
I'm so glad you brought this tale back to our attention. Not that people forget A Christmas Carol, but it does have at its center, truly, the meaning of Christmas.
And it almost didn't happen. Think
and
of that.
It almost didn't happen. Les Standiford. The book is titled The Man Who Invented Christmas. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Tanya Weinberg, and Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.